say?
We had a long lunch together, and I point out the problem. I don't think it ever did much good. It was too large a program, almost, really. It had so many people and disparate backgrounds. But that was one of the things that I thought was quite important. I can't say, frankly, that I was ever successful in getting any of the companies to do it. I mean, Grumman, the F-14 program, they eventually had a little program. I used to recommend various professors and various others who were in a position, like Jim Bill, for example, Marvin Zomas, others, who were in a position to do the kind of thing that was necessary. I mean, that's sort of an aside, really, but I felt that I will never try to give you or anybody else the idea that I was prescient whatsoever on the way things develop around. That was clearly a problem area. I'd say in those 4 years, I probably spent more time on various aspects of the arms sales program than anything else. Certainly in the remaining years of the Republican administration at the time. There was very little emphasis, particularly on human rights at that particular time. It was boiling within various human rights organizations in New York and elsewhere, Amnesty, etc. So that gave me took a fair amount of time just simply in talking with these people and the inevitable replying to letters that they had sent to the President or the Secretary of State. Most people, I don't think, realize that when the President or the Secretary of State or somebody gets such a letter from, you know, it winds its way down the bureaucratic ladder and ends up with the desk, and he then writes a letter to the Secretary, who may reply to him. You might just write it yourself, saying, "The Secretary has asked me to reply to your interesting letter of such and such date." So a fair amount of activity on that. As well as the second, but the arms sales were, to the outsider, it looks simple. They read the newspaper that the United States has agreed to sell X amount of airplanes or tanks to a particular country. Before that decision is made, the paperwork is just simply enormous. As you want, try to get everybody lined up. And often the Department of Defense is viewed as pushing arms sales. And in my own experience, at least, this is not necessarily true at all, that some of the more conservative people in arms sales are frequently are those at DOD. But it was our policy after the 1972 visit of Nixon and Kissinger to Tehran, and you are familiar with the broad outline of that particular decision memorandum that came from Kissinger at the time. It was basically our policy to sell Iran pretty much what the Shah wanted. There is in the language of that memorandum, I can't, just the exact language, not in my head right this, there are little loopholes in there that one could take resort to. But it was, the basic intent was clear. And so, but still, even though the intention was clear, there's still the bureaucratic process of getting through and getting a specific decision memorandum. And the sale of various weaponry to Iran by no means was viewed as an unmixed blessing within the U.S. government, so there's a considerable struggle over many of these sales. And again, you know, the process of writing the secretary's statement before various parts of Congress, what we call Q&A work, where you sit down with a group of people and try to think of every conceivable question that's going to come up, and you get an answer to the secretary. And frequently people on the Hill are very good about this. They will tell you in advance, if you happen to know who the staff assistants are, call them and say, what is Lee Hamilton, for example, most interested in the testimony that's coming up. And they would tell us, so you know, they understood as well as one after bit, you didn't have to explain this all. Our purpose would be to meet the representative or senator's concerns. What are they interested in? So we didn't spin our wheels, and there were all sorts of things that might be answered, but frequently you'd have a briefing book that was 6 to 8 inches thick for a particular hearing on every possible Q&A you could think of. When it came to arms sales, of course, all of those had to be coordinated with the Defense Department. So the defense representatives were saying the same thing, or roughly the same thing. So that took an enormous amount of time. I go into this in some detail because it's the point I make in talks that I give at the universities and sometimes the Foreign Service Institute, is that in Washington, and this is not an excuse at all for my lack of prescience, they're so terribly busy doing the bureaucratic necessities of the job, and around the particularly active health, they often, quite honestly, not look very frequently at the internal scene. Now, if there was a major problem in the area that the embassy sensed and reported, then of course you get heavily engaged because everybody starts seeing the incoming telegrams saying, you know, we got problems, this or that. And the country director then would, of course, would move around, become the chief coordinator, pulling things together, in terms of what the U.S. response would be to a developing situation. But in the time until we get very late in my 4 years there, one did not have a particular sense of a crisis in the making. So I criticized an enormous amount of my time on all arms sales. You may recall the problem we had with the sale of AWACS.
I was going to ask you about that, yeah.
And I used to come home and say, is there life after AWACS? I've never been so occupied in my life as with that particular sale. As you know, it was bitterly opposed on the Hill. We had at one period to withdraw and then go back later on when we worked out various assurances with the Iranian government. 5 or 6 specific assurances on the Hill sold it. They working on that, that was perhaps one of the more exhausting things I've ever been engaged in. It was just continuous. You know, you had to be dealing with the Iranian government, with the Shah in particular. I mean, dealing with the Shah since a long ways away, but through the telegrams that had to be drafted, assuring him that the withdrawal at the time didn't mean that we weren't going to push ahead, that the administration remained convinced that he could use, that he needed the AWACS, sort of keeping him calm, or at least from not doing something foolishly, which was, at one stage he said, no, I don't want to withdraw my request. And when we talked him out of it, they would be dead if it's okay. But then later in the summer, in the fall, I guess it was, the approval was granted after he agreed personally to the various conditions that were part of the sale. Probably the other area that was terribly time consuming and frankly I found totally unrewarding was the U.S.-Iran Joint Commission. But I never felt that it had started before I took over the job. The initial action was done by Kissinger. He directed, and we started having Joint Commission of God knows everybody. I thought that with some countries the Joint Commission made sense. With others who did not, I did not feel it made any sense whatsoever with respect to Iran. Honestly, this is one of the few things I guess I was correct on, or prescient on. It came in, I took one look at all the paper and work that had been done, and I said to my colleague, I said, well, I better not say for the delicacy of the ears of someone who maybe have to take this, but as a pilot, you know what. I said, I don't know that much about Iran, but I do know enough that the minister of this or that is not going to be making particularly significant decisions. Iran, and that this is basically a show, and that there's nothing that's going to go on that can't be as effectively done in strict bilateral meetings between us and the particular Iranian ministry that was involved, and work out agreements, whether it be a technical assistance which they would pay for or what have you. The Iranians, I'm not sure they ever believe this, right, but they somehow hope that the Joint Commission would prove not only helpful but decisive in getting various advanced technology into Iran in terms of joint manufacturing, etc. And again, you know, our political leadership would always sound terribly optimistic about all of this stuff. But it really boiled down, would Bell Helicopter, out of its corporate interest, wish to establish a helicopter plant or what have you. And this went all the way down the line. GE and Howard Hughes' old company. The hell is that? I can't remember the name. It's a second. It's probably getting old. But it was strictly their corporate interest that were going to turn. Obviously, they would have to get permission from the U.S. government on certain things for technology transfer. But we could not tell them. And the Iranians did expect somehow, or at least said they. So they basically couldn't understand that the United States government would order a company to establish a particular electronics facility in Iran, that they would. And I spent, as I say, enormous money. These companies' representatives were perfectly competent on their own, if they wanted, to go talk to General Tufanian, or talk to the Shah, or whomever. Or Admiral Ardalan and others, and do the necessary. But I go into this a little bit simply because we had an annual meeting of the secretary with Finance Minister Ansari. Again, an enormous amount of work goes into these things. And we had five or six subcommittees, one on nuclear energy, all that sort of thing. And again, as country director, if you want to, well, if you want to be part of the game, you got to be part of the game all the time. You can't just stop ignoring bits and pieces of it. Well, again, that took me to Iran on a couple of occasions for these meetings and preparing for the meetings here in Washington. And out of this, you know, came what, 1976, I think I could be off a year, the famous communique of the billions of dollars that we were going to have in economic exchange. Now, this is a figure that was quite literally pulled out of the air. And I met with some amusement. I had to follow my Reb Poetz, a very, very confident officer who worked for Undersecretary for Economic Affairs, he came and called me up. I said, how can you put this how can we explain this figure? He said, you know, the press is bugging the secretary. And he said, the secretary turned to me, and I said, you can't. I said, you made it up. Out of the air. So I said, you explain it. I said, there's no way in God's earth that we are going to reach that level unless by some break we establish an agreement for nuclear cooperation, so that we actually get a contract for a large reactor. Or you have to count military aid. Of course, the whole idea of the Joint Commission was to have it restricted strictly to economic and trade matters.
No arms exports.
No arms exports in those figures. The concept, I suppose, has made certain on the intellectual broad sense that the focus of the Hill and everybody else was so much on the arms side of our relationship with Iran that what we need was a counterpoise to show them the civilian side of the great links between our country and the use that America, in terms of trade figures, are going to get from the relationship, but also it was directed at the liberal community. So it's just not arms, and we have a broad relationship covering just about every aspect of human activity. And I suppose in that sense it was a useful facade. It was a Potemkin village. There was nothing much to it. A few things that ever got done under the Joint Commission, very few, I did. And the little tiny things directly with an American department, Bureau of Public Roads, and we got a contract and I help out in some road planning, and things like that. Little tiny stuff, frankly, that didn't matter very much, but it was kind of useful stuff. And but done outside the, yeah, we put in, when the communique came along, we threw it in on one of the successes of the Joint Commission that had nothing to do with it. But anyway, I think it's simply because here's another aspect of enormous time taken up for me personally and my whole staff. The one thing that the Joint Commission also, in a sense, gave a cover to, if you will, in the early stages for the negotiation with Iran on the nuclear energy agreement. And I spent, again, I was part of a working group that was established early on by the NSC to go into all of the issues on that particular agreement, and was present at almost all the negotiating sessions on the agreement. And of course the agreement was finally reached when I was in Iran at the time in Sharjah, when the agreement was actually reached. By the time, of course, that agreement came back here and was typed up, and all the forwarding memoranda and all that prepared went over to the White House. But by the time the White House had it, obviously the internal situation in Iran was causing a great concern, so the agreement was held and never sent to the Hill. It began as a period, and you look back with hours and hours and hours of time taken up, and of many, many very competent individuals. The most difficult negotiation that I've ever been part of, I, not being an expert on that, although I felt by the time we got through that I knew an awful lot about nuclear energy agreements anyways, but that was just, I was present at all, and the think sessions after, between the negotiating sessions, as an enormous amount of time went and effort went into that negotiation, of course. Nothing resulted from it in particular. So, I mean, those are the key things as country director. I say arms sales, the Joint Commission, and in particular the nuclear energy agreement. Of course, we had two visits during the time I was here of the Shah, and there's nothing like a state visit to churn up an enormous amount of paper. Briefings for everybody who's going to be present, toasts, speeches, etc. That was the first time, as my first opportunity, just briefly, to meet him and the Empress. And so I guess one of the rewards of the country director, he finally is invited to the White House. Sometimes I came sort of after dinner, sort of sneak in the bar. Sneak in through the cellar and join the happy throng after they've eaten, and watch the entertainment, have a few drinks and watch the entertainment. And of course in those years I was worked very closely with Ambassador Zahedin, his staff here. Thank you. People have a lot of divided opinion about Ambassador Zahedi. I personally thought he was a very effective ambassador. And, he did what he could. He could to burnish Iran's image and that of the Shah. That was his job. He knew probably more people in the United States than probably as many as the Secretary of State did. I mean, he was everywhere. I don't know how effective he was in one conversation, but reasonably so. I mean, of course, the lavish Iranian embassy dinners were always great fun to go to. Anyways, you know, all sorts of people there that were interesting to know. Those are some of the rewards that one got from the job.
Can you tell me how your office is organized?
I have normally two offices working for me. One, the senior one, would be considered the deputy office director today. Didn't have that title then, but that was his job. And he essentially was the political military guy who did help me in all the political military activities. And the second, who was a more junior, also was in charge of foreign and economic affairs.
Well, who were they when you first joined the effort?
Byron Morton was the senior man, and at this particular moment, the junior also that I had, his name slips my mind.
Was Michael Michaud there at some point?
Michael was there for perhaps a week or 2 weeks when I took over as company director, but that's all. And Byron took over, and the young officer who was supposed to be doing economic affairs, I can't think of his name.
Who was your immediate supervisor? Who did you report to?
Sidney Sober. He was deputy assistant secretary, and so to be my immediate boss. Of course, he would report to Roy Atherton, and then later Hal Saunders. One thing about a country director job is that you're dealing with the assistant secretary too a great deal, because he has to testify on the law. He has to go to bat on the seventh floor for your memorandum. Now you come up with the memorandum, and he's the one who's got to argue it out if there's going to be an argument. And so I spent a great deal of time with Roy. But on day-to-day matters, and Sid Sober was my supervisor. He gave me it's one of these things we sort of worked out this time on what kind of a message did he want to see and sign off on. This kind of message that I sign off and he would see it the next morning, you know, when the telegrams came out. We worked that on the trial and error. And I suppose I had a great deal, I insisted upon a great deal of independence on this. I once told Sid that, and I have very good friends to this day. We ride the bus together. And I told him that if I didn't have a certain amount of authority, I didn't want the job. And if not worth the headaches, if I was just going to sit down and have somebody looking over my shoulder every second.
Now, who were some of the key officials at other departments who worked on ramp around this time, 74, 75?
Well, then the research area at CIA was Ernie Oney. In the early part of this period, at the Pentagon, Bob Murray was there, and Howie Fisk, General Fish, and DSAA was the key one over there, and his whole staff, they're all gone. You know, I've left those jobs now, I've forgotten many of their names, but I don't. With General Fish as much as I did with anybody on the arms sales and the preparation of testimony and the briefing of particular teams going out to the country, etc., contract terms, etc. At Commerce, people were the lead, had the lead role in the subcommittee on trade and finance and stuff under the Joint Commission. Baker, who's now Secretary of Treasury, was early on the man at the higher level that we dealt with. But that was fairly brief.
Did the NSC have a person working on Iran at this point? I know Harold Saunders had earlier, but...
The one I dealt with primarily on Iran was Bob Oakley. This being the earlier part of my period there.
Oakley?
Bob Oakley, who's back there and in the NSC right now. And I, later on, of course, with, Gary Sick. So those would be the two people I dealt with primarily in Iran affairs. This goes back 13 years. There's a couple of other people I dealt with on the nuclear energy, but their names are gone, frankly, at this point.
Now, you said by the time you came, country director, the policy was pretty much in place.
Yeah.
How would you characterize the general U.S. government approach towards Iran around this time?
Well, with respect to the arms sales, we've already gone into that.
Yeah.
That came out of the Kissinger memorandum. I've written so many speeches and statements on this, I should be able to express myself eloquently. I probably can't this morning. We viewed Iran, as the U.S. government did, as starting from the larger point of view, as of extreme geopolitical significance, always have been. This is consistent. If you read all the documents going back into the 50s, you find this basic thread was all the way through right up until the end of 1979, really. And there is no doubt that we viewed Iran's security interests as largely almost really parallel or even coterminous, same as ours in the area. Iran was viewed as, under the Nixon Doctrine, the Guam Doctrine, in essence, as a nation that could, on its own, if provided the arms and had, etc., could be the significant power in the whole Persian Gulf area. And as you know the Guam Doctrine as well as I know, if a regional state and has the capability and would act in a responsible fashion, it'd be in lieu of our actions, really. Vietnam experience led Nixon quite correctly to judge that the United States role was going to be limited in various parts of the world, and that we had to find, he felt we had to find, friendly states that would assume some of the security roles in the area. And when you think of it, I mean, it would be very difficult to find an area in which there were significant differences in our national interest. I think this is something, of course, many Iranians, particularly the crowd that came to power in 79, or after 79, really misunderstand the fact that it wasn't the United States sort of telling the Shah what to do. I mean, what was driving the relationship. From the late 60s on, the Shah acted very much as his own man, and particularly after the oil boom, gave him the wherewithal to be very much his own man. But if you go back in those days, our relationship with Egypt had its ups and downs. The Shah was greatly concerned by what he felt was the Nasserite threat in the area. We probably shared that somewhat. The Shah was supportive of Israel in the terms of trade and in terms, of course, of sold oil. He did it for his own purposes, which was somewhat different than ours. I mean, he viewed Israel as sort of a prickly hedge that would keep the Arabs off his, what he saw at his back, that as long as Israel was there, Nasser, and of course later Iraq and others, could not turn their attention to him. Our policy towards Israel had a different motivation, but we ended up at the same place for quite somewhat different reasons. His interests, I always thought that he acted, the government of Iran, and he acted in a very responsible fashion in the Gulf itself. And they did come to the agreement on Bahrain's independence. They did come to agreement on median lines with, I think, all the countries in the area, so that oil exploration could go on without continuous disturbances. His attitude and policies towards Afghanistan were very supportive, if you will, of our own. And we wanted Afghanistan simply to be a strong and neutral, monoline country. We were always concerned in terms of, you know, the Soviet threat in the area. And he saw the Soviet threat in the area much even more stark than we did. So one looked upon the relationship in the mid-70s as a coming together of the national interests of two countries on almost all issues. After the Shah had considerable money, and by this time Sadat was in power, he came up with various economic aid projects to Egypt. He came out with an offer of a substantial economic assistance program for Afghanistan. It was more fluff than that in substance. But, in the mid-70s, and even up through probably 77, so much of 77, one saw a very satisfactory relationship, and I'm not sure he, by and large, saw it the same way. But I think many Iranians look upon us as the superpower continuously meddling in his affairs and directing him, and I think as the record comes out, the documents and all these things, and many of them are out, it shows a very equal relationship, if not the fact that he ran the relationship more than we ran it. From the 50s on, I mean, there's just simply the underlying concern about the Soviet Union, Soviet expansion in the area, and this drove policy, and still drives policy.
How was the Prussian Petroleum factored into the perception of, I guess, national interests in the region?
Up until the, I'm not quite sure where to go on this question, but up until the 73, explosion prices, we just didn't get heavily engaged in the petroleum issue anymore. In fact, when I was in New York in that period, some of the representatives of the major oil companies took a couple of us out to lunch and wanted to know why the hell we had withdrawn as a government so completely from oil negotiations. But if you go back to the Mossadegh period, the 53 period, we were heavily engaged in setting up the consortium, et cetera, et cetera. So the companies themselves, really, with practically no input that I am aware of from the U.S. government on their dealings with the Shah on prices and terms. Obviously, the great increase in oil prices in 73 and various jumps, I should have corrected myself, hardly an issue of disagreement amongst us. This was, of course, this was a major problem that we had, not only with the Shah, but of course with all the others, except certainly in 73, the Shah took the lead in getting oil prices up. He always explained that after to us as that if he hadn't stepped in, prices would be even higher. You can buy that or not that. Well, this was a point of friction, definitely. I said a happy relationship was, except that this was a major one. In part, I think the Joint Commission idea was an effort to mop up, if you will, some kind of the excess currency. I don't think that I'm not sure what Kissinger ever really felt about the major increase in oil prices. We did an awful lot of talking. I think an awful lot of people in Washington did feel that oil prices were too low, now and that the countries who were getting oil income, that this was not a totally unjustified shifting of resources, from the developed countries to the less developed. This is the talk of everybody who went around would talk with him. I would write the briefing papers on it, from other sources, and talk to the shadow leadership about the impact of high oil prices. And it was an irritant in the relationship. But he had developed his own theory about the prices of oil and natural resources, and that what we should try to work out is sort of a world index of various prices, and that oil would go along with that index. And he'd always point out that a particular thing that he had bought to X dollars in 71 now is 2X kind of thing, and that oil price, that the increase in oil price is one more justified increase, and really that oil exporting countries were steadily finding inflation in the goods that they bought from the Western world. And he would always give us many, many examples of what had gone up. I think the one time that I recall, I know Ford talked to him about it very briefly. And of course, when he visited with Carter, he had agreed before he came to Washington not to have an oil price increase for that particular next 6 month period. You know, OPEC was doing sort of every 6 months adjusting prices. And that was a nice friendly show. I think at the time I felt this, and again, I felt it was a very politically very dangerous thing for him to do in terms of his domestic audience, his degree as he meets with the president, not to have an oil price increase, that this was going to, but I think history is correct, as well, many Iranians looked again as his toying to American pressure. Or it wasn't that, it was his shrewd assessment. I think that oil prices probably should stay stable for another 6 months. That was sort of a freebie to give us. While he was adjusting his relationship with Carter, he wasn't quite sure how that relationship was going to work out over the entire term. So it was, in that sense, internationally, it was a shrewd move. Domestically, it probably was a very bad move on his part.
Now, going back to the period in 74 or 75, did Kissinger ever make any formal protests to the Shah against the price hikes?
Oh, yeah. Every time they would talk about oil prices.
Yeah.
I can't give any specifics. My memory is not that good anymore on that particular issue. Quite honestly, I get tired of the issue. I felt, frankly, that, I don't know what Dick Helms has said about it, but Dick had to carry the load very frequently on the oil issue. Mm-hmm. I just felt it was one in which we were trying to spin our wheels if we got over agitated by it. And continue the pressures of the prices to along there, a certain degree of oral pressure, if you will.
Uh-huh.
So the prices didn't go out. Go completely out of control, but I felt that the other was not think, a lot of flack from around the country on this, with senators and representatives, you know, can't be clawed by the Shah on this. And I felt that, I say, I keep up a degree of pressure, but the totality of the relationship should not be undermined because of oil prices. And I think that's certainly what the Secretary and the administration, both administrations, came down on us, that the relationship has so many rewarding features that don't let it be really badly harmed or destroyed or badly affected by our dispute over oil prices. Of use the special relationship if you can to at least have a moderating impact on the oil price.
I asked you during this period, like November 74, Kissinger went to Tehran to talk to the Shah about oil. Was it pretty much an effort to moderate the Shah's policy, basically?
As I recall, yeah. Yes. November 74, I think, was the... He went there in 74, was that? I forget whether that was in connection with the... Joint Commission.
That was one aspect.
Because last night I went out on that trip. Yeah. I was just trying to remember the 74 or 75.
Well, you traveled Kissinger too.
I didn't travel. I went out separately. But yeah, I was there for the meetings of the Joint Commission.
Uh-huh.
I did not have the honor to accompany him to his audiences. But Dick Helms was with him. I've read all the Mem Cons and all of them. I've forgotten the content of it.
Okay. You know, a few months later, February 75, Undersecretary of State for Economic Affairs, I guess Charles Robinson, accompanied former Treasury Secretary George Shultz to Iran in February 75. Also discussed oil prices with the Shah, from what I've read. Do you recall anything about that particular, any preparations that you might have been involved in for that mission?
You know, it sounds terribly, it is 14 years ago.
Yeah, yeah.
There's nobody went to Iran or the State Department or probably anywhere in the U.S. government that my office didn't prepare the briefing papers. But they sort of blend all into one at a particular time.
Okay.
And Chuck Robinson was very active in the whole Joint Commission concept. He was very active in the oil issue. It was, sort of, was his baby after a while. And quite an effective operator. I spent a great deal of time in his office talking with him about the oil issue and other economic issues with Iran, and a couple of visitors who wanted to talk to him about Iran, that sort of thing. But specifically, I just simply... Wait, turn that off a second.
Now, by this point, for many years earlier, the U.S. had intelligence and communications facilities in Iran. They were used for monitoring Soviet missile tests and so forth. Now, on June 74, this memo drafted by Mike Michaud, when I went through the 2 weeks he was at the desk, I guess.
When was it drafted?
June 74. You signed off on it. I have a copy here. It was stated, the Iran desk needs for information as to the nature of the military and CIA intelligence and communication facilities in Iran. So how cooperative were they in telling you what they were up to in terms of these various installations? Did you ever find out very much from them about what was going on? What their operations involved?
In that particular operation, I was, as I recall, I certainly forget the memo. It's been my first week, my first couple of days when I was there. If you have a copy of it, I'd like to look at it.
Yeah.
Thank you for letting me look at the memo. It refreshes my brains a little bit. Yes, I was aware of the facilities before I came on the desk. And they're part of the national means of verification, whatever that phrase is, which the Soviets understood too. But we did not have a really full appreciation of the numbers of people and importance on them. And I did get a briefing. No, I didn't come out of knowing a hell of a lot more than I went in with, because I'm not being a technician. But yeah, they were there for the verification. Yeah, we could look down on their test range and monitor the various signals that were used. That sort of briefing was probably 10 or 15 minutes. But On this, I, as a general proposition of my career, many of my foreign service colleagues wince whenever I say this, but I always have, if I requested assistance or if I requested briefing from CIA, I never found any reluctance. I have an excellent relationship at every place I've ever been, and in Washington, I don't know, with CIA. Obviously, CIA, the agency is not going to tell me or anybody else, if they can, who is a controlled source, if they happen to have one in their country. Uh-huh. That's not my business. But the the information from that source is either distributed throughout the government, or the people at the agency would brief me. I think I was helped in this respect by the fact that many of the people in the operational division, I won't get into their names, were friends from previous posts. So that made a office hire to the State Department, for a State Department also to get to know well the operational people at the agency. It works in different ways. I think it's probably better now than it was in my day. I know many desks had no relationship with operational, but did have a relationship with the analytical side. And I think probably my own, just simply knowing the people involved helped. So that I used to have, probably some of them I'd see. So.